I served a parish in Albuquerque before coming to Holden. And we used to take our confirmation class to the Jewish synagogue once a year. And the rabbi, after the synagogue service, the rabbi would meet and answer questions from our class. And remember one year, one of the kids asked the rabbi, what's the difference between Judaism and Christianity? And I was very interested in what his answer would be, and this is what his answer was. He said, Judaism teaches people how to live on this earth, and Christianity teaches people how to get to the right place when they die. You know, and like it or not, this is what Christians had communicated to this rabbi, and I don't think he was very far off in his answer. And so that really got me to start thinking back over my background and my religious upbringing. And I remember just some things came back to my mind. One was when I was a child, I remember praying at night, and the last thing before I went to sleep at night, I would ask God to forgive my sins, and then I'd quick get to sleep. Because if I would have an evil thought or something, then I would have to have the prayer all over. And then if I had the evil thought without the prayer all over, if I die, and I mean, did you ever wonder why we thought about dying at night? I mean, what did we pray just before? If I should die before I wake. So if I died then before I woke up, then I might go to hell. So that's why I wanted to get to sleep right away. I remember my confirmation when I was in ninth grade, and I had braces all over my teeth and rubber bands and all of that. But I remember at that confirmation being in a religious situation that had a lot of rules. Almost seemed like anything that was fun was wrong. That was almost how you could tell if something was right or wrong, was whether it was fun or not. And I remember a confirmation, make a promise to God, is I'll put up with this Christianity during the years of this life so I can go to heaven when I die. I almost kind of, at the confirmation altar rail, I remember almost making this deal. And then when I think back on this, I think the rabbi was right. I mean, how much of our Christianity has been tied somehow to getting us ready to go to the right place when we die, or scaring us that we might go to hell? And I would, I want to get tonight to ideas have histories and we can make connections, and I'd like to share a little tonight about how the idea of hell came. And also an alternative idea that's also in the scripture I want to show tonight. But first, I'll just draw this model, which has been very typical for all churches. And this is all the way from, left to right, or however you want to go in the Christian church. This has been tended to be the model of what the Christian faith is all about, is a person is born, a person lives, a person dies, and then when a person dies, the soul of that person either goes to heaven or goes to hell. And then the purpose, everything that we talk about related to the Christian faith has to do with where you will go. And if you are a what is called a born-again church, then it's a conversion experience that you have at some point in life that then will make the difference when you die, whether you go to heaven or whether you go to hell. If you're a more sacramental church, it might be baptism, and then the sacramental system, then it gets you ready. But they're similar, and this is what the purpose of the church is, to either give the word for the conversion experience that will get you ready, or give the sacramental system of water, baptism, and other sacramental ritual. And I'd like to start, I shared a little, what do you remember about your upbringing. Was this a strong model for you, or a strong picture or an image when you were growing up? Did any of you stay in the church just to avoid hell when you die?
My experience then was just exactly as you described, and I was chuckling when you were saying that. All those good things. I couldn't play baseball on Sunday because that was a sin.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, the God that loved me, and how could he say that I couldn't play baseball on Sunday? It was all don't. And it wasn't until I guess when I got older and I had another Lutheran minister that really introduced the concept of grace. It isn't what I do, it's what God did for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very grateful for the Lutheran church for opening my eyes on that.
No.
But mine was just like yours.
And what you had then at death was a great reversal. All the people that had a miserable life as a Christian then started having fun at death, and then all the people that had fun in this life would die, and then they would start having their miserable time. No, it wasn't a bad deal. Just a few years of this stuff, and you could, well, I suppose I'm sharing some of my feeling. There's a slight possibility. What about some of the others? Does this model ring a bell with your upbringing? And
well, I certainly wondered with my Catholic friends what Lutherans did with purgatory. We just ignored it, or when we split from the Catholic Church, we decided that didn't fit, or what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because many of my friends were very strongly influenced by that.
Yeah. Also, one thing I learned very early was the difference between Lutherans and Catholics. When Lutherans died, they got to go to heaven for doing nothing, and Catholics had to do something. It's like I heard a Lutheran pastor was on his deathbed, and he says, "Lord, I'm ready to come home. I haven't done one good thing in my life." Well, purgatory. Sometime I want to get it charted. I have a chart of Thomas Aquinas and his scheme of the afterlife, and purgatory is just the beginning of the complications of all of the different passageways and places and waiting areas. And did you ask a question?
No, just make a comment.
Just make a comment.
Can I add
have to explain purgatory.
No. Can I add another one?
Okay.
And that is that this model fits for me until I was in about fifth grade and I had a baby sister who died after a day. And I remember my parents rushing to the hospital. My dad wanted to baptize her before she died, which raised a lot of questions for me about what if you didn't get there on time, hadn't baptized her while she was still living, would she have gone to hell because she wasn't baptized? And I think my father did a fine job of explaining to me that wasn't particularly how we believed, that we did feel it was important. We didn't get there in time. It wasn't our decision where that child would go. And basically our belief was that she wouldn't be condemned to hell.
Yeah, we connected this to baptism, didn't we? The fear of a baby dying before baptism, keeping the baby in the house so the baby wouldn't catch a cold before the baptism. And if there was an infant death before baptism, the terror that parents went through because of this.
I remember the things that were said about heaven didn't sound very interesting.
You want to
experience. Streets paved with gold, people singing all the time. It just, as a child growing up, really, I pretended that it sounded great, but when you sing those hymns, it really didn't grab me at all.
I had a little guy in Sunday school one time, and we were talking about going to heaven and all this kind of stuff, and he said, no, I don't want to go to heaven. He says, I want to stay right here with my mother and dad.
Reminds me of this is a quick story, but Billy Sunday, I guess, had a heart attack once while he was preaching, and he was preaching about the wonders and glories of heaven, and he woke up and just asked them to rush him to a Mayo clinic in Rochester. And when they got him there, one of his followers said, "You described the glories of heaven, and when you had a chance to go, you chose to go to Rochester." there are some other hands.
What she said about purgatory, she made me think of my 5 years in the Catholic Church. And I guess maybe because I wasn't in the Catholic Church for my whole life, I saw purgatory as being kind of a day of judgment thing. But my whole life was very much one of sackcloth and ashes. And I was sure that I was going to go to hell. I mean, anything that I did was a sin.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I got into the Lutheran Church and learned that, you know, you are saved by grace alone. And then all of a sudden, it made sense to me. And I began to think that maybe I did have a chance to get into heaven.
So it was a freeing thing or a
yes,
liberating
yes.
thing. Anybody else, or should I go on?
I remember when I was in really a especially spiritual mood back in high school. Or junior high, I can't remember which. I remember the horror of thinking that the absolute certainty that my father was going to go to hell. I remember that sense of real impotence when I would think of how much he didn't know and how impossible it would be for him to be any different than he was. And that I knew this, I was so certain of it, and I had this certain image of what hell was. And I was always in, I was, there was a brief period of real misery imagining him in hell. That was awful.
Yeah, I've, you know, been with people in this terror as a loved one has died that wasn't active in the church. And the terror of the thought of that person burning in flames.
I remember the feeble attempts my sister made at saying, "Well, you know, he's a good man." she would try and soothe me with all these sort of,
yeah.
"Well, he's always been he's been a really good father. I'm sure that'll be considered." So I had this horrible image of him trying to defend himself in front of God.
I remember the real concern with a neighbor that we had, who was very kind and a big family, and committed suicide. And they couldn't have a funeral in the church.
Oh, yeah.
And how that affected all the children in the family. And most of us didn't know why not. Mm-hmm. But that was a real challenge.
And not having the funeral in the church, the connotation
kind
of that, is here and here.
I grew up with something very similar to what you've drawn there. It's a little farming community in Michigan. Though, and there was more emphasis on heaven, and maybe that was because with a lot of family members and there were people dying, it just came out. I remember I was only about 4 years old, my great-grandmother died. I can still remember what she looked like, but it was emphasized she was going to heaven. And then if grandparents and great-aunts and great-uncles would die, they were going to heaven. So it was like what you're describing there, but more of an emphasis.
The emphasis was on that part.
Heaven rather than hell.
It was a more positive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, hell was popular when I was growing up, too, and I remember that it really raised havoc with my confidence in God's mercy and his love. And finally, I remember experiencing a great deal of resentment about a God who played games with us that way.
Yeah. Any of you remember reading Jonathan Edwards' sermons, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God? It isn't fair sometimes, that's the only sermon of his that some people read, but he has a human being like a bug on the end of a string, and God is holding the bug over, is that what it, over the flames of hell, waiting to let go, you know.
I don't think, growing up, that I ever really took hell seriously. I don't think I believe in it. Because I think back to my childhood, I don't think I ever believed that there really was such a place, and that ever happened to anybody. And that, so that's a big perspective.
That's interesting. You've been kind of a rebel.
I'm laughing.
Yeah. Jim?
No, I was thinking similar problems I had in the Oakland school and in moving here, but some of my black athlete friends, their thoughts were that, you know, when we had discussions that this was the old slave idea, and I should carry through that this was a hell on earth, but we had a good place to go to. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of reassuring to me, to counteract it, the other thoughts.
This has been a marvelous scheme through the ages for the oppressors, you know, to teach people that we don't have to worry about the status of people in this life or equality, you know, because everything will be worked out in heaven. You know, it was a good game, and some people say the civil rights movement in this country really started in a way when black preachers of the black church stopped buying this and started preaching something else. Yeah. What I'd like to, all I'm going to do now is share two things. One is in moving into this idea in the Bible and in the New Testament, what I've discovered is two irreconcilable ideas that are in the New Testament, and in order to live with that, you have to live with the Hebrew mind of paradox. There's one way we could deal with this is take our scissors and cut out all of the eternal damnation passages out of the New Testament. And I don't know if you know that Thomas Jefferson did that. Took a scissors to his New Testament, cut out everything he didn't agree with or wasn't comfortable with, and he published his New Testament. And I just saw in, it's in the Smithsonian, I guess you can see. I guess it's still printed too, you can get copies of Thomas Jefferson's. That's one way. The hard thing about this is that, you know, sometimes we like to say, well, the idea of eternal punishment is something that other people talked about, but Jesus didn't. And when you read the New Testament, Jesus said more about it than anybody else. So that's one of the first difficult things. We usually like to think, well, Jesus will be always on the side of niceness. So it is in the New Testament, and what do we do with it? Okay, then the Hebrews have a sense of paradox that you live in the mystery of God with seemingly totally contradictory ideas, and our kind of more Western scientific mind, we'd like some way to figure out a way to reconcile them or to figure out what is right and what is wrong. And I'm going to show you these because this is in the New Testament. In fact, it's our gospel for tomorrow. The separation of the sheep and the goats, the sheep going to their eternal reward and the goats going to their eternal punishment. We have that in the New Testament. Then at the same time, I've discovered in the book of Revelation, in the book of Ephesians, in the book of Colossians, in some of the Kingdom of God teaching of Jesus, there's an idea that almost excludes this idea that's also in the New Testament. And then the question is, why has the church really picked one of these pictures to the exclusion of the other? Okay, and the other really comes from Hebrew thought about God's wonderful future, of God bringing the world to shalom, or God restoring the world to the Garden of Eden. And this scheme would be like this, that this is history, and history is moving, and history is moving to a point of shalom. And these are the passages from the Old Testament of the lion and the lamb lying together, the child feeding them, nations no longer fighting, turning their swords into plowshares. all the nations streaming to Jerusalem, up to Mount Zion, to learn the way of God and live in peace. The Messiah coming and restoring the kingdom or the Garden of Eden, again to the whole universe, the whole creation. When you get into the writing like of Ephesians and a part of Revelation, the history itself is moving to a shalom that includes all creation and everything in the cosmos. And it is so specific that there's no room in that vision of God's future for any kind of pocket of existence that is separated from God. And we're going to look at the Bible study tomorrow morning. We're going to look at one of those passages, which is Ephesians 1, 9 and 10. I hope I can find this because I didn't take time, and I have it marked in my big, heavy Jerusalem Bible that I don't like to carry in the snow because it throws me off balance. Yeah, it's Revelation 5. Now, I'll read this and then ask you, is there any place in this vision of God's future for any kind of a hell? And by the way, remember that also the same book, Revelation, is a book that also talks about eternal damnation and the lake of fire for the wicked, if you want me to continue to keep us confused. This is a vision of the future. The Lamb and all the elders and the creatures are all singing a new song. You are worthy to take the scroll and to break open its seals, for you were killed, and by your death you bought for God people from every tribe, language, nation, and race. You've made them a kingdom of priests to serve our God, and they shall rule on earth. Again I looked, and I heard angels, thousands and millions of them, and they stood around the throne and the four living creatures and the elders, and they sang in a loud voice, "The Lamb who is killed is worthy to receive power, wealth, wisdom, and strength, honor, glory, and praise." And I heard every creature in heaven and earth and the world below and in the sea, all living beings in the universe. Shall I repeat that? All living beings in the universe. This includes the bugs and the sinners. And the stars. And they were singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise, honor, glory, and might forever and ever." And the four living creatures, which I think in Revelation are the representatives of all of creation, answered, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped. Well, this is one example of what's sometimes called the universal vision of God redeeming the entire cosmos and not having one square inch, if you want to use that, of the cosmos that is not redeemed. Okay, now that these two ideas stand together. Now, in this model, and this is again so specific in the book of Ephesians, the purpose of the church is not specifically to get people ready to die so they'll go to heaven, but the purpose of the church is to be pockets, or sometimes I've called them bubbles, where God's future shalom is lived in the present, and the church, and by living that shalom in the present, witnesses in a world that lives in a different way what God's future for the whole cosmos will be. Now, depending on these two schemes, you get a whole different idea for almost every word that we use in the church. Take a word, evangelism. Here, evangelism is to get people converted so they'll go to heaven instead of hell when they die. And this, evangelism is to bring people into the joyous anticipation of God's future shalom so they can experience that in the now, long, long before God will bring it to the whole cosmos. In this scheme, salvation is you're saved, and this is in our culture almost always what we mean by being saved. It means you're in some type of a state, so when you die, you'll go to heaven. In this scheme, salvation means the very basis of the biblical word salvation, which means wonderful space to live the full and complete human life in shalom. And by living that, you anticipate again God's future for the whole cosmos. That's salvation. Baptism here gets you ready to die, so you'll go to heaven. Baptism here is that doorway of entry into one of these bubbles of existence that anticipates God's future for the universe. Okay, now I want to leave that and then just briefly give you the history of hell. Okay, are you ready for this? Because ideas, one thing about our biblical faith is that we say ideas just didn't drop down from heaven like the Book of Mormon. And I'm serious that it's a difference between Orthodox Christianity and Mormonism. Mormonism has a book that dropped down to heaven, and therefore that book can never be questioned. Christianity in its Orthodox sense is the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. People encounter God in the experience of life, and out of this encounter come forth with the confessions that are in the Scripture as to what God is all about. And so therefore ideas have history, and God works through the community as it struggles with ideas, and those ideas go on. So I want to show you, it helps me understand and live with this scheme or this model and see how important the understanding of punishment was to certain people in our family of faith. And I think once we get this history, we learn to appreciate why it was an important idea for biblical people and an important idea for Jesus. Now we'll start. This I need notes.
Yeah, just one question.
Sure.
In your second thing there of the history, anticipating shalom, does that mean that there is no concept of choices on people's destiny? That all will, like read in Revelation, all will be engulfed in the shalom?
Yeah, it's hard. It's difficult with the passages as they are in the New Testament, if you move with that passage, to have a final eternal two places or two areas of existence, one where God is absent. I think even in our second lesson for tomorrow, we have this of God filling all in all. That's where I said, I think finally, when you push these two ideas to their conclusion, they're impossible to reconcile. And the question is, do we have enough trust in the mystery of God that God has it figured out and we don't?
Just a comment on what you were saying. Merton, in these tapes that we could listen to, he talks about religious knowledge is different than any other kind of knowledge. And that you have to take the two extremes, like this judgment day of heaven and hell, and also moving into the eternity now, and just have to kind of play with them to come out to the truth. Mm-hmm. But if you carry either one to an extension, they contradict the other, and then both of them contain the truth.
It's only in faith that you understand how you live in the middle of the tension. And you can't explain that any other way. I can't.
He can, so I'm going to try.
And Thomas Burton. Old Testament people only had one place after death. I'm going to show how this place gets, the architecture of it as what we would call in modern days room additions. And it was Sheol. And to the person of faith in Old Testament times, when you died, you continued your existence, but you went to Sheol, which was kind of a shadowy existence that the closest thing that I can think of is when the alarm goes off in the morning and you're not quite awake yet, and there's that few seconds before you really realize what's happening. You know the feeling? That's Sheol. When you die, you go into a shadowy, semi-conscious existence that's dark. It's on the gloomy side. It's silent.
Think of really forgetting your life on earth. And it's desireless, passionless, kind of a shadowy, half-awake, half-sleep. And therefore, to Old Testament people, your life with God was your life on this earth, and your extension into the future was through your children. That's how you lived an eternal life, was by extending yourself into the future through your offspring. So you have this, so that was the Sheol. Now, an understanding of eternal reward and eternal punishment really came out of the terrible phase of crisis. It was one of the momentous periods of Jewish history. By the way, there are two passages in the Old Testament that specifically talk about a resurrection or an afterlife where you're awake. And if you want to look those up, it's Isaiah 26:14 and Daniel 12:12, and they're both passages that come at the very, very end of the Old Testament period, about 150 AD, when the ideas I'm going to talk about were developed. But this moment, this crisis period in Jewish history was 167 to 164, and it's called the Great Persecution. This is when the Seleucids, the Syrian Greek controlled Palestine and the Jewish people, and the ruler of the Seleucids and the Antiochus IV tried to wipe out Judaism from the face of this earth. And the persecution and the death and the horror and the torture of this time was terrible. Now, what was happening is that the Jewish people had always lived with the understanding that if you follow God's law faithfully, you will be blessed. You know, and that you disobey God's law, it will bring to you suffering and anguish. And now what they were experiencing was the reversal of that. It was the Seleucids that were against God, that were evil, that were enjoying good days, and those who were faithful to God were dying. And so out of this came what we call the apocalyptic literature, which among many other things believed this, that there will be a day in the future where there will be a judgment. And God will step onto the stage of history and will make things right. In other words, those who are faithful to the covenant in that day will be rewarded with a good life. And those who oppress the faithful people will be punished when God steps onto the stage of history. Okay, so that was the first development. Now the second faith question they asked was this: what about the faithful Jews who, because of their faithfulness to the covenant, have been killed, are martyrs? We can't leave them in Sheol. God will not leave them in Sheol. But if God keeps the promise of faithfulness to covenant people, then it must take place in the afterlife. to see how the idea of soul Sheol now becomes divided into two rooms. And one room is called Gehenna, and the other room is called Paradise. Okay. Now, Gehenna is the place of the dead now, of those, the wicked people who die and are those who have oppressed the covenant people of God. Paradise is where those who have kept the covenant wait until this coming day of judgment, and then they will be raised, and then they will be given life by God. So now you have this waiting area of two rooms, and now the rooms get further and further separated into the realm of the dead, and they're fairly geographic about this. Is way down under the earth where this is going on. God is in heaven, which is above the dome of the sky. These places of waiting now are under the earth. Now, if you'll catch this, that the faith cry and plea for a Gehenna, oh, I should explain where the word comes from. It was an area outside of Jerusalem which had the memory of being a place of child sacrifice during the pagan times, that had become the Jerusalem garbage dump. So Gehenna, the most literal translation of it would be garbage dump. Apologies to the garbologists. So you could say that every day you go to hell. That's what it was called in Jerusalem. You know, Gehenna was where you went and dumped your garbage. And the garbage and litter was burned, so there was flames there that you could see there day and night in the valley of Gehenna. Then paradise was a beautiful garden that came from the Persians. Persian experience that the Jews had. Remember, it was the Persians that freed the Jewish people from the Babylonian captivity. Well, now in the teaching of Jesus, you have Gehenna and paradise. Remember the story of the rich man and Lazarus? And the great divide between the two areas. And the rich man went to Gehenna, and the poor man went to paradise. Or what did Jesus say on the cross to the... Today you will be with me in paradise. And Jesus here was in that concept of the time. He wasn't talking about what we would sometimes call heaven, but he was talking about the waiting area for the last day of judgment or the righteous wait. Now, what's important is this idea came from oppressed people who were believing that if God is a God of justice, then God will finally make things right and vindicate their suffering from those who are oppressing them. You know, and thus, I started this by just mentioning the sermon I preached. Maybe until we are oppressed and are suffering torture for the sake of Jesus Christ, maybe we don't have a right to plead with God, are you going to make things right against our oppressors? Now, and if you read in the book of Revelation, there's a funny tension that goes on in the book of Revelation. That at one time, the book of Revelation will say only those whose names are written in the book of life will enter into God's New Jerusalem. Then other places in the book of Revelation, hell or the burning lake of fire seems to be reserved for a few Romans that are oppressing them, and then paints a picture of all the nations coming after those who have been specifically oppressing the people of God go to eternal punishment. But if you could hold on to that idea that
this came from oppressed people, and the idea is continued by unoppressed people, ideas in the Bible tend to get really messed up. You know, does that... I think what happened in the Christian church is that these two ideas lived in their tension until Constantine. And at the time of Constantine, when the church assumed worldly power, the whole idea of the church being kind of a foretaste of God's future shalom just was irrelevant. You know, when the church is running the world, or participating in running the world, and therefore the idea then of paradise then becoming what in English we call heaven, Gehenna becoming what in English we call hell, and then the faith almost got centered, especially through medieval times, and then even up to Rome time, of this being the main point of who goes to paradise or heaven or who goes to Gehenna or hell. Well, that's all I'm going to say. I'm not answering any final questions. I'm just bringing up the history of the idea, the alternative that seems to be in tension with the idea in the New Testament. Now, what do we do? The coming, you know, to the Jewish person, the coming of the Messiah would be to establish the kingdom of Shalom, or God's final kingdom. And it was the main argument that Jewish people had against early Christians. You know, how could Jesus be the Messiah when the world isn't as much of a mess now as when he came? Jewish people still use that argument, and it's a very effective argument. The Christian response has always been that when Jesus came, Jesus was the Messiah and brought the Messianic kingdom that will reach its fulfillment in the future, which sometimes we call the Second Coming. But then as the Messiah, Jesus in his storytelling used the concept of hell, but if you read the New Testament, he always used it at religious people. Because by the time of Jesus, it had not become an idea of... it had become a racial idea. But if you were Jewish, you were going to eternal reward. If you were non-Jewish, you were going to eternal punishment. Gentiles were considered fuel for hell. And Jesus had all kinds of fun telling religious people, you know, you might go to hell yourself. Or you might, and the way Jesus told it mostly is you might be left out of the Shalom banquet. And Jesus used it as a warning to religious people who were not following the way of justice and mercy in this life. Now I went on beyond your question, but that's how... And again, it doesn't finally answer the question of the tension.
The second idea is brand new to me. How long has this idea been around, and how come I haven't heard about it before?
It's all over the New Testament and the whole Bible.
I know, but it wasn't taught to me.
I know.
Is this just something new that theologians have come up with to explain passages that don't fit into the other explanations, or is it something that has been around for years and years and choose to ignore it?
Yeah, I think it's a powerful idea in the New Testament, and it ties the New Testament to the Old Testament. You know, I think probably it's been ignored because we can't live with tension, and the other idea was much more convenient. Andrew Greeley said it in some ways in his little book, The Jesus Myth. You know, if we can't convert people with joy, we can at least scare them. That's my paraphrase of what he said. Yeah. I don't know that I mean, it has, it's been rediscovered, I think, in a contemporary movement to really go back to the Bible and try to figure out what the Bible really says. And, you know, was there a...
So what I want to know, was this theological extension of what you're saying, what I'm going to say? Good. So if there are Christians today that define themselves as counter to the rest of society, then from what you're saying, does that mean that they don't have to talk about heaven and hell anymore? If you put them back before the time of the Constitution, then we don't have to worry about that, and we can just live in the second one?
I can just say what I think. It might be an extension, but I don't know if it's a logical extension. I think we've so misused the idea of hell that I personally would just think we should have a moratorium for a while until we find again a way to talk about it authentically. I don't know what else to say.
So that's what you can tell people, you know, if they want to say, ask you, what about the passages in the Bible about hell? Mm-hmm. What do you say? You say, well, I have a different conception?
One thing I'd say is maybe go to Central America with some poor people that maybe can talk authentically about hell. That cry under having their faces crushed, or as the old prophet said, you know, grinding the face of the poor. I think passages about God's judgment against people who choose to do that might, through their eyes, begin to make sense. Instead of the way we've used them as these neat little distinctions, if you're a human being that has said the words, I accept Jesus as my personal Savior, that means you get your eternal reward. And if you're a person that hasn't said that, then you're going to burn in hell. I'll rebel against that idea and say that's how we've misused it. And we've used it as a cheap form of evangelism. When the apostles went out into the world with the gospel, it was a joyful message of the kingdom coming and the resurrection of Jesus. And to go out in this world with this wonderful, with this scary message that if you don't buy what I'm giving you, you're going to burn. And that's what we have done. And again, it's as I said, when you take the deep, deep cry of oppressed people and it's then used by unoppressed people, it gets all messed up. Well, I don't know. Finally, I don't know.
Yeah. Do you have any sense, if you sat in a room with Lutheran theologians worldwide, not just American, what might be the split, if you will, between the two ideas, and where in 1984 most Lutheran pastors or theologians would stand?
The reason I'm smiling, I'm a picture person, and I was seeing this room. The first thing I was saying was, who invited me?
So you called me?
No, I called me. I don't know. You know, it's surprising how little you see written on this.
That's exactly
it's large, you know, and I found when I'm out in the churches, the question of eternal punishment and eternal reward in the afterlife is almost the first question that tends to be on the minds of lay people, and to find anything even written about it, you can't. I think there's a few things that are starting to come out now. So, hey, do you think I'm right?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. So a crying question of lay people, I think, has almost been ignored.
Well, I find it's the question most often asked me by non-Christian persons. Because that has often been the turn-off point for people who were raised perhaps in a Christian church or background, and heard that message and said, that's not for me. And they say, Mary, is that where you come from? And is that your belief? Mm-hmm. And then I come with very little background or education to respond to that.
Yeah. That second concept, Dan, is surely a lot easier to explain to the non-Christian people, our Buddhist and our Hindu friends, some of those people, because I've had Christian people, some of the fundamentalists point about, you know, those people right off, you know, there's no way that there's a place in heaven for them. And my answer has always been, well, I think that's somebody else's choice, and maybe we're not God to make that decision. But this concept here, I think, would make it easier to explain.
I mean, this, it's a vision that's shared, I mean, it's shared with our Jewish friends. Gandhi had this vision. Read the biography of Gandhi and then try to reconcile Gandhi going to hell with any idea of God that you have grown up with. You know, you will just scream out against the God that would have Gandhi burning in hell because Gandhi was never baptized because he got kicked out of a white church. They wouldn't let him in. Then are all those people that kicked him out of the white church that didn't allow blacks going to heaven because they're baptized and Gandhi's going to hell? I mean, you just the spirit that is in touch with Jesus cries out, no. Anyway, my spirit does. I shouldn't assume. And yet, Jesus used the idea as a warning, especially to religious people. We can't forget that.
The other thing I like about this is that you can have fun in the church. The Christians are happy people. When I was a boy, they were all somber. Nobody ever smiled or laughed in church. You thought, like you say, all the things that were fun were condemned. And I like it all because I think since I've understood grace, I can laugh and have a lot of fun and do a lot of things that you can play baseball on Sunday.
You know, this universalism, if that's what you call it, is most offensive to people who see religion as miserable. Say, my goodness, these people that are having fun not being religious better get it after they die. And the difference between that of saying the joyfulness of entering the life of faith, that I have the gift of grace to participate in God's future now. And maybe, again, it's a question, or maybe God will call the whole cosmos into that shalom in the future. But the joy is not that I get it and others get left out or booted out, but the joy is that I get to share that future vision now in the life of bread sharing, in the life of forgiveness. And that's why, you know, some people say, well, if you accept this idea, then there's no reason anymore for evangelism or for inviting anybody else into faith. Well, again, that's a misunderstanding. Do I invite people into the faith so they'll be on the heaven side of the afterlife? Or do I invite them in the faith that they too can participate now in God's future shalom in their present existence in community here on this earth?